5, verses 1 to 32. I suppose it had to happen eventually. I've been at NREC 3 years next month, and so far managed to avoid preaching on a genealogy. Well, I suppose that's not quite true. We did look at the genealogy of Jesus in Luke 3 when we were considering those early chapters of Luke's Gospel. But in that instance, the genealogy wasn't the whole of the passage we were looking at there. It was tagged on to Jesus' baptism. But here, we're doing something altogether more daring. The whole of our passage is genealogy. Although having said that, I think I am still being broken in gently. This genealogy certainly isn't as bare as some of the Old Testament genealogies that you come across. It's when I announced that I'm going to preach a series in the first few chapters of 1 Chronicles that you need to really take a deep breath. But this morning, we come then to this relatively benign Old Testament genealogy. And I just want to briefly identify three features of this genealogy. Three features of it. And first of all, then, this morning, I want to suggest that it's graphic. It's graphic. Now, graphic may not be the obvious word that springs to your mind when you read this passage. Repetitive, perhaps. Uneventful, maybe. Graphic, probably not. Surely you can't get much less graphic than a list of obscure and unpronounceable names. Surely I've got the wrong word in kicking off with this particular adjective. Well, let me explain why I'm suggesting this word to you. My father recently had his 70th birthday, and so one Saturday last month, the family got together, mum and dad, the three sons, the three daughters-in-law, and the four grandchildren, and we all went off for a nice meal. And one thing that we made sure that we did that day was have a family photo. And I'm sure then that by the next time we visit Thirsk, that photo will have appeared on some mantelpiece or wall or something. And some of you may be grandparents or perhaps even great-grandparents, and you perhaps have a photo like that in your house, a photo in which you are sitting on a sofa or bench or something in the middle, surrounded by this array of children and grandchildren, and possibly even, as I say, great-grandchildren. And it's quite something, isn't it, to look at a photo like that, to look at this reasonably sizable group of people of all different ages, and to be able to say that every one of them, apart, I suppose, from the sons-in-law and daughters-in-law, every one of them can be traced back to those two people sitting on the sofa in the middle. Now, of course, we don't need a photo to inform us of that particular fact. It's pretty basic biology. But the photo brings it home, doesn't it? The photo makes it vivid that all these people have come from those two people. The photo makes the whole thing graphic. Now, in the ancient world, of course, you didn't have family photos. But what you did have was genealogies. And in a genealogy, then, the first name to appear, the name at the top, the name at the start of a genealogy was, I think, pretty much the equivalent to the person sitting on the sofa in the middle of a family photo. And all those other names which then come after the first name in a genealogy, that whole list of names, that was pretty much the equivalent to all those smiling faces gathered around the sofa in the family photo. And you see, the intended effect was something quite similar. The intention was that you should read a genealogy and that you should say, wow, all these people and every single one of them can be traced back to that first person. Every name on the list can be traced back to the one that appears first. And again, that may seem pretty obvious, but to set it down like this, to set it out in the form of a written genealogy, it made it graphic, it made it vivid, that all of these people have come from that one person. And so coming then to this genealogy in Genesis chapter 5, the first name that we have here is, of course, Adam. I know God is obviously mentioned first, but the first name of the actual genealogy is Adam, who that begins then in verse 3. And the intended effect then of this genealogy was that one should read it and say, wow, all these people, not just the people in the early stages of this list, but even the people in the latter stages, even Enoch and Methuselah and Lamech and Noah, even those people can all be traced back to this one man, Adam. At no point, in other words, in between Kenan and Mahalalel, for instance, or in between Enoch and Methuselah, or in between Lamech and Noah, at no point had the connection with Adam been lost or severed or terminated. At no point had a new genealogy had to begin, because the old one had now just petered out and lost momentum. At no point had a new list had to begin with Kenan or Jared or someone like that. Or to bring it up to date, at no point had a new photo with a new sofa with new occupants had to be introduced. But just keeps on going. The connection with Adam just keeps on going. And I don't think Moses is ramming this home, but I think he is making a point here that this is a connection that simply doesn't get broken. This connection with Adam doesn't get lost. It doesn't get severed. It doesn't get terminated. Moses, of course, is in a context much later on. Many centuries, many millennia have passed. He's addressing these Israelites who probably would have identified themselves very much with their great tribal heads, with Levi and Simeon and Judah and so on. And Moses, I think, is subtly reminding them, look, this connection, the connection that we're seeing so vividly and so graphically in Genesis 5, it doesn't get broken. It continues, it goes on and on. He's wanting to plant this sense within them of Adam as this inescapable presence whose shadow stubbornly lingers over all subsequent history. That, I think, is what Moses is trying to do in this genealogy here. And it doesn't just apply up until Moses' day, but the connection which wasn't lost or severed or terminated from Adam to Noah, or from Noah to Moses to the time of the Israelites, it still hasn't been lost or severed or terminated, even as we come to 2008, even as we come to the 21st century, as we come to this very point at which we find ourselves this morning, still this connection with Adam exists. Still it's there, still it's a reality, still all of us can be traced back to him. Still all of us are his descendants. And in reality, that family photo that I was part of a few weeks ago was a very incomplete thing. And the family photos in your houses are very incomplete things. Because really, sitting on the sofa in the middle of the photo should be none other than this man, Adam. And what does this mean then? What does it mean to have this connection to Adam? Well, I think the passage shows us it's a good thing and it's a bad thing. First of all, it's a good thing. It means that we inherit the image of God. Look at the first three verses. So this is the written account of Adam's line. When God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them male and female and blessed them. And when they were created, he called them man. When Adam had lived 130 years, he had a son in his own likeness, in his own image, and he named him Seth. Now, often people look at verse 3 and see it as a negative thing. Here, Adam kind of passing on to Seth his own image. Seth kind of bore the image of Adam as if this was something bad. But I don't think that's the point. We could perhaps illustrate it in this way. Suppose a man has a son, and that son really resembles him very strikingly in his physical appearance. He really resembles his father. And then suppose in time that son has a son, and the resemblance continues. So there you have three generations with this strong physical resemblance. Now, you could say of that third lad, you could say, couldn't you, that, well, he looks just like his grandfather. He has the likeness of his granddad. Or you could say he has the likeness of his dad. And those two comments would be interchangeable. There wouldn't be any substantial difference between those two comments. And I think that's the situation that we have here, that God made Adam to resemble him. We've looked at this in past weeks. Adam resembled God. And then Adam had a son, Seth, who resembled him, who resembled Adam. But you could say of Seth either that he bore the image of Adam, the likeness of Adam, or that he bore the likeness of God, and those two things are interchangeable because Adam bore the likeness of God. And so, although here it's put in terms of Seth bearing Adam's likeness, that I'm saying amounts to the same thing in this context as Seth bearing God's likeness. And I think what this is doing is simply confirming the fact that we've said all along in this series that the image of God, the likeness of God, wasn't something that existed for a little while prior to Genesis 3. It was something which Adam passed on to his descendants, and they passed on to their descendants. It's a something which has continued and has continued to be passed down through the human race. And that's a good thing, isn't it? That's a wonderful thing. That is good news. Many people will tell us today that we have descended from animals. Well, if that's the case, what have we inherited from animals? What have we inherited from the apes or whatever that we have descended from? Well, I suppose we've inherited the intrinsic value of an animal, so that there wasn't anything particularly wrong in what Hitler did at the Holocaust. It wasn't a Holocaust, it was a culling. He was killing 6 million animals. And the same with any crimes that you read of in the newspaper or see on the television. They're all against animals. They're all against those who have descended from animals, who have the intrinsic value of an animal. To mistreat a child, to mistreat a woman, to mistreat 6 million Jews, to mistreat any human being, it's mistreating someone who has the intrinsic value of an animal. That's bad news. It means there's no real moral responsibility. You can't ultimately accuse these people of doing anything too terribly wrong. But if we, in fact, have descended from Adam, then we've inherited from him the image of God. And that makes the whole thing utterly different. It means that Hitler was killing 6 million people, bearing the very likeness of Almighty God. It means that every crime, every mistreatment of another person that you ever hear of is the mistreatment of a man, a woman, a boy or girl bearing the likeness, the royal, noble likeness of Almighty God. It's good news that we inherit from Adam, the image of God. So it's a good thing that we descend from Adam, but it's a bad thing as well. And don't you see that in this passage? Because what is one of the most notable features of it? Is it not that refrain that we have at the end of every paragraph? Verse 5, Adam lived 930 years, then he died. Verse 8, Seth lived 912 years, then he died. Verse 11, Enosh died. Verse 14, Kenan died. And so we could go on, this chilling refrain, so-and-so died. And we've been going through Genesis slowly, and perhaps it doesn't hit us as forcefully as it would do if we were reading in a single sitting, because it is powerful, isn't it, in the context of Genesis. I suppose we've had the murder of Abel, but we haven't had much exposure yet to death. And yet here we have now, just in our face, he died, he died, he died, he died. And why is that? Why are all these people dying? After all, they seem so healthy. They're living almost a millennium, many of them. And so why, even in the case of these guys, why does death eventually overcome them? Well, it's because Adam, you remember, in the Garden of Eden, he broke that prohibition and so incurred the death penalty of God. He became guilty and he became liable to death, and he passed that on to his descendants. He passed it on. That state of guilt and liability to death, he passed it on to each of these guys. And he's passed it on to every descendant, every person descended from Adam. He's passed it on to you, and he's passed it on to me. And I'm saying then this morning that part of Moses' purpose in giving us this genealogy here is to show this stubborn connection with Adam that doesn't go away. And I want us to understand that connection with Adam that we all sustain this morning. And I want us to understand that that's a good thing, because it means that we haven't come from animals. And it means that we do inherit the image of God. But I want us to know it's a terribly, terribly sober thing as well, and a solemn thing and a somber thing, because it means that we have inherited Adam's guilt. And it reminds us that what we need as human beings, our great need, is not to become better people. It's not some kind of reform. Our great, real, basic need as human beings isn't to clean up and live better lives. That's just tinkering around the edges. Our great need as human beings is to substitute this connection with which we are all born to Adam with another connection, with a different connection altogether. Our need is for that connection to be replaced. Our need, as I'm sure you can see where I'm going with this, is to have a new connection established with a new Adam, with Jesus Christ. That's our great need as human beings. You can improve yourself. You can become a good person. You can really try hard to be decent. And perhaps at external levels, it will be apparent to people. You can really improve your habits. You can stay away from bad things. You can try and keep to good things. But it's tinkering around the edges. You're still connected to Adam. Your great need is to get out of him, to get away from him, and to become connected to Jesus Christ. And the rest of the Bible is telling us that that happens when you exercise faith in Jesus Christ, when you come to lean upon Jesus Christ in trust, in faith, in surrender upon him. Then you get this new connection with him. As Paul puts it so commonly in his letters, you become a person in Christ instead of in Adam. You become a person whose whole state is dictated by Christ, not by your biological ancestor, Adam. Have you done that? Have you come and placed your faith in Jesus Christ? Is it true of you this morning that the connection that's made so graphic in chapter 5 in your experience has been replaced by a new connection to Jesus? So it's graphic. Secondly, this genealogy is focused. It's focused. Because is it not the case that as you read it, your eyes are drawn to a particular point? There's a focal point, isn't there? There's a bit that stands out in this genealogy. And it surrounds Enoch, doesn't it? in verses 21 to 24. Enoch stands out. He stands out as someone who is described differently, someone with reference to whom the same refrains that we've had throughout aren't necessarily used, or at least are altered. Enoch is, as I say, a natural focal point, who draws your attention to him. And that's interesting because last week we were looking at the second half of Genesis 4. And there we didn't exactly have a genealogy in the same sense that we do here. But there in the second half of Genesis 4, again, you had a line, didn't you? There is the line of Cain, of course, not the line of Seth, as we're looking at now. It was a line of Cain, and we're told of descendants. We're told of who Cain's son was, and who his son was, and who his son was. So there was a similarity. We had a line of descendants in the second half of Genesis 4. And there too, there was a focal point, wasn't there? There too, in the second half of Genesis 4, there were many names. There was an Enoch there, there was an Irad, there was a Mehujael, there was a Methushael. There were many names, but there was a focal point. There was one person who stood out, who was focused on more. And it was Lamech. Lamech stood out in the second half of Genesis 4. And what's interesting is that both Lamech in Genesis 4 and Enoch now in Genesis 5 are at the same point, aren't they, in the two respective lines. They're both the seventh generation. Lamech is the seventh generation in the line. And Enoch here is the seventh generation in the line. And so I'm saying then that in the second half of chapter 4, the seventh person is focused upon, Lamech. And here now in chapter 5, the seventh person is focused upon and is treated differently, Enoch. And why is that then? Why is the writer, why is Moses here using this particular device? Well, is it not that once again we are being referred back to Genesis 3:15? Is it not that once again we are being shown here that great program of Genesis 3:15, the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman being fulfilled and being implemented in history? See, we've already been shown it in the first generation from Adam, haven't we? Cain and Abel, the seed of the serpent, the seed of the woman. And now we're being moved on to the seventh generation. And again, Moses is saying we have the same thing, the seed of the serpent, Lamech, and the seed of the woman, Enoch. And Moses then is just giving us another little reminder, another little hint that, look, this is still going on. God's great program for history is still being unfolded. Still, these two seeds are running in parallel lines. Lamech, you see, a man who is so proud and so violent in his disposition, as we saw last week. Enoch, on the other hand, a man who walks with God. And is it not the case that Lamech looks like the serpent? Isn't there a real resemblance between Lamech and the serpent? The serpent, what did he do in Genesis chapter 3? He brought death, didn't he? He came into that garden intent upon bringing death cascading upon Adam and all Adam's descendants. That's why Jesus calls him in John 8:44 a murderer from the beginning. The devil has been a murderer from the beginning, from the Garden of Eden. That was his intention, to bring death. And here's Lamech in chapter 4. And he's just like his father, the devil. He's just like the serpent. He's a murderer. He's gone and killed a young man who has injured him. And he's threatening that anybody else who touches him will be killed to a devastating extent. Lamech looks like the serpent. And yet here's Enoch in chapter 5. And doesn't he look a little bit like the ultimate seed of the woman? Doesn't he look a little bit like Jesus Christ? Because what are we told of him? We're told, well, as we've already said, that he walked with God, that he had this intimate relationship with him. But then this very intriguing detail at the end of verse 24, that he was no more because God took him away. And what's the ultimate seed of the woman going to do? Well, he's going to destroy death, isn't he? He's going to blast death to smithereens. We've sung about it this morning. He's going to rob death of its power and its sting. Because he's going to go into death as the substitute and exhaust death on behalf of his people and so leave death this powerless force in relation to his people. He's going to really kill death. He's going to make death die. He's going to destroy death. And here in Enoch, of course, we don't see that happening yet, but we see a little foreshadowing of it, don't we? We don't see Enoch blasting death to smithereens, but we see Enoch at least putting a little puncture in death. At least showing that death isn't this invincible force, unbreakable and impregnable. And mustn't the serpent have really trembled when he saw this man Enoch? He's already seen Abel and already seen that God is serious about fulfilling his Genesis 3:15 promise. And the sight of Abel must have made the serpent quake. But the sight of Enoch, Enoch eluding death, Enoch exposing the weakness of death, which is the serpent's very chief weapon, of course. Death is what the serpent deals in. The writer of the Hebrews calls him the one who has the power of death. And yet here's Enoch, and he's not quite grasping the sword right out of the serpent's hand, but he's at least loosening the serpent's grip on death and reminding the serpent that one day someone will come who will completely disarm the serpent of his sword and will leave the serpent an utterly defeated foe. And this focal point then, just this sight of Enoch, just like the sight of Abel in chapter 4, does it not encourage our hearts? Does it not remind us then of the wonder of God's purposes, the wonder of God's redemption, the wonder of God's commitment and determination to overthrow Satan and what he had achieved in the Garden of Eden? And doesn't it challenge us this morning? Have we placed our faith in the greater descendant of Enoch, of whom Enoch was only a foreshadowing? Just as we challenged ourselves when we were looking at Abel, have we placed our faith in Abel's greater descendant, the one whose blood speaks a better word than Abel's does? Well, have we placed our faith in Enoch's greater descendant, the one who really destroyed death, the one who really finished death, the one who really broke its spell? Is your faith in Jesus Christ this morning? As you read of Enoch, do you leap forward to Christ and embrace him as the answer to this terrible need that you have of death being defeated? So we said then that this genealogy, it's graphic because it brings out so powerfully this connection that we have with Adam. We've said it's focused because it particularly draws us to this man Enoch, the seed of the woman who points us to Christ. But then thirdly and finally, this genealogy, it's purposeful. It's purposeful. Why is it that we're told so little of these people? Why is it that they are just names? After all, we've got people here who are living for centuries. They must have done all kinds of interesting things in these long lives that they lived. Methuselah there, living for 969 years. What a life story he must have had. How many successes, how many heartbreaks, how many domestic crises, how many ups and downs, how many events of all kinds of different natures. So why doesn't the narrative stop? Why doesn't it pause and linger a little on some of these people? Why doesn't it give us a portrait of these people to which we can relate? Why doesn't it make them real human beings? Why does it just go so fast over all these people? Well, the answer, I suppose, is in the caption, which certainly my NIV is there above the chapter, from Adam to Noah. God, you see, is wanting here to almost rush us on to Noah. He's shown us the story of Adam and all that has unfolded there. And now he's wanting to whisk us away to Noah. And all these other names, they're just links on the chain to get us to Noah. And why is that? Well, isn't it reminding us of the very nature of the Bible? That at the end of the day, the Bible isn't just this kind of rather clumsy collection of stories about different periods and different people. It isn't this clumsy collection of biographies, so that you have almost randomly Jacob's life taking up such a big section, and yet Jared, in the middle of this genealogy, we know nothing about him. But rather, the Bible is a purposeful book. It's a single story, and God wants to take us through that story in an ordered and coherent manner. And the reason then he wants to take us quickly now from Adam to Noah is because Noah is the next chapter of this story. And what is this story? It's a story of redemption. The Bible is not just this chaotic book with some interesting stuff and some important truths. And if you kind of spend enough time kind of rummaging around, you'll find a lot that's useful. It's not like that. It's this one story of God's redemption. And Adam then is the first great chapter, and now we're going on to Noah, this next great chapter. Just on that, isn't it interesting the way in which the chapter does conclude with Noah? And we're told in verse 29 of Noah's father, Lamech, and it's obviously a different Lamech to the one we've just been talking about. And we read that he named his son Noah, and said, "He will comfort us in the labor and painful toil of our hands caused by the ground the Lord has cursed." Isn't that an interesting prophecy that Lamech utters as Noah is born? It reminds us, I suppose, doesn't it, that of the sheer hardness of life for these people that we're reading about in Genesis 5. You think of it. We were told back in chapter 3, "By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food." And here we're told of people living for 700 years, 800 years, 900 years. 900 years of eating by the sweat of your brow. 900 years of toiling over the creation. You could see Lamech feels it, doesn't he? Lamech feels the bitterness and the hardness and the sheer adversity of it all. And yet he prophesies of his son Noah being someone who in some way will address this problem. In some way will address this cursed world. In some way will remedy and rectify the curse that is laboring upon the ground. And what did that mean? Did it mean that Noah was going to be some kind of eco-warrior who was going to somehow solve all the environmental problems of the world at that time? Well, not a bit of it. Noah was going to be someone who preached the holiness of God and the grace of God in salvation, the grace of God in saving men and women from the consequences of sin, if they will accept that salvation. And I think the point is that there lies the hope for even the cursed ground, doesn't it? The ultimate hope for the cursed ground lies in the message that Noah was going to preach, a message of a holy God who in grace has saved people from their sins. Because it's that message of Noah's which alone holds forth the vision, ultimately, of a new creation, a new heavens and a new earth. And it has implications for ourselves that while I think environmental programs and so on are things that we should seriously engage with as Christians, it's reminding us that the only ultimate hope lies in the gospel of God's grace in Jesus Christ, God's grace in saving sinners. That message alone holds forth the vision of a new creation in which the curse on the ground is no more. But to come back to my main point then, this is reminding us, this rush with which we move from Adam to Noah, it's reminding us that this is the story of the Bible. Indeed, it's interesting that with this genealogy, as in so many of the biblical genealogies, the number is very, it's a round number, it's 10. There's 10 generations in this genealogy. And the numbers are very significant, aren't they? You think of Jesus' genealogy in Matthew 1 and the 14s that you have there. And I think all of that is reminding us again, these aren't just random collections of people's lives. This is God here doing something purposeful. And in this case, it's God moving us on to the next chapter of his great redemption story. And I just want to close then asking you, have you understood what the Bible is all about? Not do you know a lot about the Bible, not did you go to Sunday school, not are you able to answer questions about the life of Noah and the life of Jacob and the life of Jesus and so on. But do you understand what the Bible is for, what its great purpose is, what it's doing, what the big picture is? It's a story of God redeeming. And I encourage you, if you've never engaged with that before, to recognize it and to read the Bible, looking at it through those spectacles and praying to God that this great story of redemption will be something that you will be caught up in and that you will come to participate in. So it's a difficult passage, but I hope we've been reminded this morning of our connection with Adam that needs to be replaced, of Enoch, this wonderful foreshadowing of the destruction of death itself through Christ, and of the whole purpose of the Bible, the story of God's redemption. Amen.